Up From Adams Street by Larry Crane. Read by Maxwell Zener. When I was 5, Sandy, Ethel, and I made a habit of trekking across the tracks to Grandma's house on Saturdays. It was a 2-story colonial they'd built with Grandma's father's money. It had a hot air grate in the floor of the dining room and a grand, weeping mulberry tree in the front yard with branches that touched the ground. To us, the tree was another better house. We climbed the front steps, crossed the porch, and entered the living room quiet as a moth. We knew Grandpa was there, behind the newspaper. His enormous fingers were pinching the edges of it, snapping it to make it play out. His shoes were tapping at the rug to keep his focus on the newsprint, not on us, standing in a clutch on the other side of the hassock.
"Lottie," he called.
Grandma's name was Charlotte. She was a tiny woman with a hunch in her back, standing at the kitchen door, greeting us with a conspiratorial "come, come" motion of her hand. We watched the paper come down, revealing Grandpa's solemn face and white hair. He was peering over the glasses that had slid down to the tip of his nose. He was wondering, we think, which brood is this? Our hands were clasped in front of us, almost as if we were facing inspection. We sidestepped around the hassock and filed through the dining room to the kitchen. Which brood, indeed. Ma was just one of his 8 children and 21 grandchildren. Grandma was at the bare, oblong wood table. We surrounded her. She looked older than Grandpa. Her teeth were pulled, probably one for each of her 8 children, leaving her mouth sunken. In a batch of 6 photos Grandpa had mounted in a frame on the wall, she appeared to be a young woman in a cloche hat, jolly and playful and willing. Billy pushed the ball down to the floor and glided to the hoop with 4 long strides, 2 dribbles with his left hand, crossover, and 2 with his right. He elevated effortlessly and angled a soft shot off the backboard that glanced through the hoop. He came back toward us languidly, the ball in one hand against his hip. Just the way he slouched, you could see he was a pro.
"Coach," Benny Yannakopoulos said, raising his hand.
"What is it, Yannakopoulos?"
"Benny.
On the court, it's all last names, partner. Call me Coach."
"I can't do this, Coach."
"Before you even try?
You still have 5 guys for the games."
"You're not quitting, Yannakopoulos. End of that discussion. You think I'm letting a potential all-star quit the team?"
Billy bounced past the ball to Yano.
"Now take the ball. Dribble in for a shot. You're the first of the Mohicans, pal."
We gathered in the barracks in a nearly square room, one side of which was separated into 2 sleeping areas, one side with a single bunk and the other with a double. 3 desks were clustered in the center of the room, and adjacent to the windows were a sink and a mirror. On the opposite side of the room was a fireplace that hadn't had a fire in it for a very long time, if ever. We stood in a crescent with Bullock in the center. "The uniform of the day is always worn in a prescribed way, the same as most things we do here. It's not haphazard, not individualistic. Mr. Coughlin, step forward and turn your back to the rest of the squad. Gentlemen, your classmate, Mr. Coughlin, is wearing his short-sleeved white shirt improperly. What do you suppose is improper about the way he is wearing his short-sleeved white shirt? Mr. Needs, what do you think?"
"I don't have the slightest," Needs said.
"Say again."
"Sir, I don't know the answer, sir."
"We don't slap in an extra sir whenever we feel like it, Needs. Say it again."
"Sir, I don't know what's wrong with the way he's wearing the shirt."
"What shirt?"
"His short-sleeved white shirt, sir."
"Good. His short-sleeved white shirt doesn't fit snugly to Mr. Coughlin's body, and it slops over his belt all the way around. That's not the way we wear a shirt. Mr. Needs, step forward and stand in back of Coughlin. The rest of you move so you can see what's going on."
At a gathering at John Ferguson's house in Dover after another Army-Navy football game, I invited Anne to come east again. As we sat outside John's house in a car, she told me of a telephone call she'd gotten from Dad, a bolt from the blue. The folks had received the latest issue of Pointer, the cadet-inspired quarterly magazine, probably the Femmes issue. It's what had set him off.
"Dad called you?" I said.
"Yes, he was all excited," she said, rubbing her hands together.
"Tell me, whose father has the gall to ring up his son's girlfriend on the telephone?"
"Yours." "I don't know if I should say anything," she said. "He's gotten a fire burning under that red mass of curliness again. He thinks I should contribute something to the Pointer Summer Edition."
"Oh, my God, is that nervy or what?" I said.
"It's seriously audacious. I love your mom and dad very much and could throw my arms around them and hug them both every time I see them. They're both such individualists and unaffected, and Ma was in on it too? It's crazy. He builds a person up to a goal. I'm sure you've felt it lots."
"All right, let's have it," I said, leaning back against the door and facing her, my arms crossed.
According to psych dialogue, he plays a person up to the goal and works on their feelings of inadequacy.
"Oh, shit," I said.
Anyway, I hightailed it over to your house and picked up some back issues of the rag, including a couple Femmes issues.
"So you took him up on it?"
"You could say that," she said, looking away out the side window.
From Up From Adams Street by Larry Crane. Read by Maxwell Zener.